we see God when we're not expecting him, is in the unexpected places. And so I wanted in that poem to capture something of the surreal nature of where God chooses to show up and what it's like to experience him. And it's not all mountaintop, or it's not all, you know, pastel colors, or it can be sharp, it can be gentle, it can be poetic, it can be a little bit violent, it can be all kinds of things.
Abigail Carroll serves as pastor of the Arts and Spiritual Formation at Church of the Well in Burlington, Vermont. She holds a PhD in American Studies from Boston University, and most pertinently for today's conversation, she's an accomplished poet whose third collection of poems, Cup My Days Like Water, a set of meditations on the Psalms, was published just last year, 2023. We talk about these new poems, particularly the connections between poetry, stillness, prayer, and what it means to seek and follow inspiration in one's life and work. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Abigail Carroll, Abby, it's such a pleasure to finally have the opportunity to talk with you in the podcast. Good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me. It's delightful to be here and to talk with you, Matthew.
It's a joy for me. We planned this conversation months ago, right? Then our podcast had the technological glitch that kept us offline for like 3 months. So thank you for waiting. During the interval between the time when we initially planned to have this conversation and now, I sat down with my friend George Hanley for our annual episode on some favorite books of the year. And as you know, I listed your 2023 collection of poems, Cup My Days Like Water, as my favorite book from last year. Have you been pleased with the book's reception? And for you, what constitutes a positive reception for your work?
Well, first of all, let me just say thank you so much. I'm just so honored that my book would make your top books of the year, let alone number one. I just don't even have words. In terms of its reception, I think for me, the real joy in writing is the writing itself. If a book is published, that feels like a tremendous blessing. And it does, in some ways, increase and multiply the delight of the initial joy of writing, but the real joy for me is in the writing. And so I consider the book to be a success because the poems were written. everything else is a bonus. However, I do think that it has been positively received, and I'm happy about that. I don't pay attention to the numbers of the book so much. My interest is really more in how it's resonating with people's lives. And when you get a glimpse into that, that's just such a gift. A reader recently shared with me that she had a copy of the book and her father was diagnosed with cancer, and she gave him a copy as a gift and then wanted to buy a second copy for herself so that she'd still have a copy of the book. And that to me is what it's all about. And I will say a special unexpected blessing that has come my way is that two choral arrangers, one here in Vermont and then one in Winnipeg, have asked permission to set some of the poems in this book to music for choral groups. So that's very exciting.
Wow. That is exciting. I mean, I'm not surprised, but it's still, you know, I think a real tribute to the great work you're doing here. In fact, someone just told me yesterday in an email, this is someone who loves the Psalms, that heard the podcast where I mentioned your book, and he heard the word Psalms. I was describing your book. He's like, oh, and he went and picked up a copy. He's loving it. So it is a book that I think really speaks to a lot of people and for different kinds of reasons, and it's a beautiful book. You know, time permitting, we'll talk about not just this collection of poems, but also maybe a poem or so from Habitation of Wonder, your previous collection. Mm-hmm. Let's start, though, with Cup My Days Like Water. So again, these poems are all meditations on the Psalms, right? They're not so much paraphrases of the Psalms as much as they are poems inspired by lines in the Psalms. At least that's how I read it. Can you tell us about the inception of the poems, right? Had you been wanting to craft poems after the Psalms for a long time, or was this a more recent burst of inspiration?
I think the idea had been brewing for a while. I've found that writing a series of poems has been very rewarding for me. Instead of just writing piecemeal poems, which is, of course, a wonderful way to write too, but it's a little bit like inventing the wheel every time because every poem is its own distinct piece of art, so carefully crafted and so short, relatively speaking, right? And so when you're in a series, you know where you're going when you finish a poem, and it cuts. It just cuts so much of the waiting and wondering about the next poem out of the equation. And so after I wrote A Gathering of Larks, which is actually a series of poems, those are 40 poems that are written as letters to Saint Francis of Assisi, I was considering, well, what could be my next path or series? And the Psalms came to mind very sort of intuitively, but they also felt very overwhelming because, you know, there's 150 of them. They're also such historic, beloved, devotional literature. I mean, after all, they are scripture. And so, but I realized, you know, I'm someone who interacts with the Psalms daily. My life has been impacted by the Psalms. So in a sense, I lay a claim to them. They're mine too. And I thought to myself, if I were to engage a larger project, writing poetry inspired by the Psalms, this could be a devotional opportunity. It could be like a spiritual exercise. And how would that impact me? And who would I be on the other side of that? And so, you know, why wouldn't I see if poetry wanted to come out of an engagement with the Psalms? And so when I felt I had no other path to go down, I decided that this would be the one I would try. And I think it helped by focusing on psalm by psalm rather than thinking of it as a larger project, just one poem at a time, one line at a time, you know, one translation at a time. And so, as you mentioned, I didn't try to capture the essence of a whole psalm in my poems. Just I borrowed a line. I borrowed the voice of the psalm by taking one line and letting that be a seed for the poem. And I let that voice speak into my world and say what it will.
I love that, right? Because it means that the poems that you write are psalms in their own right. They aren't just
That's true.
imitative, right? They become psalms themselves, right? So they're psalms upon
Yes.
psalms, which I think is fantastic. You know, I know people who regularly meditate on the psalms as a spiritual exercise. I myself don't have that practice so much, but I do read them frequently, and they're beautiful. I'm often struck by how many of them express anguish, right, at wounds or slights. They call down God's vengeance right on the psalmist's enemies. That is not the tenor of your poems in this collection at all, right? Your poems are much more about recognizing God's presence in the world in far, far gentler ways. As you were composing these beautiful poems, did you reflect at all on the difference of the ones that you were crafting from many of the psalms, or was it the resemblances between your poems and the psalms that most impressed you?
Yeah, you know, I tried to make sure that the compilation as a whole, would touch on all of the major notes of the psalm. So, you know, the praise and the lament, the gratitude and the imprecation, nature, justice, beauty, violence. And the collection, I think, does touch on all of those notes intentionally. But in allowing myself to write my poems out of an individual line, as opposed to an attempt to represent the whole psalm, I definitely ended up with a collection that was not, it is not precisely parallel to the psalms in terms of its economy of lament or its economy of imprecation. Eugene Peterson says this about the psalms. He says that God is the primary subject of the psalms, and the second subject after God is enemies. And that says a lot, right, about the Psalms. And my poems do touch on lament, and they do touch on the subject of enemies. But overall, I would say they are less marked by darkness than by light.
Yeah, that was my sense for sure in reading them. Though they do have, there are poems of quite a beautiful variation, I thought, also. A lot of variety in here. You know, so many of the poems in the collection carry about them kind of an aura of what I kind of call it an exquisite stillness. So in my conversation with George Hanley about why I love your collection so much, I commented there that there's little in your poems that seems loud to me. Instead, these are poems calibrated to a still, small voice. Mm-hmm. And they're also kind of almost synesthetic. There's sensuously enriched voice to these, you know, where a sound can touch on an image, and that image merges into a shadow, and that gives birth to thought. So it's something very delicate and very fine-tuned about how these poems work. And it's in this attentiveness, I said to George, that that at least for me, I discern your deep love for God. Now that's a reader. That's me coming to your poems as someone who really is very enthusiastic about them. Do they signify the same way to you, or do they seem very different, you know, in the mind of the poet?
That's a great question. And I just want to thank you for being such a thoughtful, careful reader of the poetry itself. And I love the term that you used, exquisite attentiveness. That's such an honor. Like that is for sure what is in and behind the poems. It's beautifully named there. But to know that somehow it somehow at some point met the mark is very encouraging. And I think your words attentiveness and stillness definitely resonate. And I think of stillness as a prerequisite for attentiveness. Almost stillness is, you know, the stilling of the body so that the spirit and the mind can be attentive in ways that it might not otherwise be able to be attentive. And these things are also, I think, prerequisites for prayer, at least contemplative prayer, right? Yes, I would say this body of work signifies stillness and attentiveness, but I would say beyond that, for me, it signifies prayer. And, you know, in the Psalms, not every Psalm addresses God directly. There are Psalms that address the soul, like one's own soul, or the Psalms that address a listener, a reader, a congregation. But that doesn't mean that those Psalms aren't prayers, because I think that we can like overly define prayer as a certain thing when it's actually a broader thing. The Psalms were written devotionally, right, before God, for God, even if they're addressing a congregation or they're addressing one's soul. And so in the same way, I think not all of my poems directly address the divine. Some of them do, some of them don't, but they were written devotionally. And in that sense, they're each a prayer. And they're just simply a rendering of the heart before God. That's how I think of them.
No, it's beautiful. Maybe that can help and lead me to this question right here then. I'd love to ask you a bit about this prayer in the heart before God. I want to ask about inspiration. There's a beautiful poem in the collection. There are many, many beautiful poems in the collection. Okay, here's just one. This is a poem that is titled, "At Eight, I Thought God Lived in the Rafters." I want to read this and then ask, I've got a question for you about it, all right? So maybe I'll read this one, then we'll read some poems, both of us back and forth here in this collection here. Here's this poem. "At eight, I thought God lived in the rafters, my eyes fixed on the cross beams, converging in the church's apex, pointing like an arrow to the sky. At 11, he ambled with me through clover from back door to clothesline, lighting a wick in me I hadn't known was there. At 16, he whispered what he wanted from me in my left ear, and I spent the rest of the day ill in the back seat of a car. I wondered at 19 if I could die for the Lord as I stood in line, white-robed, swaying to the choir, glory, as he drowned me in a flood. The Lord said her at a yard sale, age 26. She handed me my change and the story of her move. That's when I watched a widow weep on her kitchen floor. At 31, I met the Lord at a lake, edged with silence and hazed peaks. He taught me to wait. We sat for a summer, tasted the blazing close of lilting blue days, and I was full. At 36, I tasted the Lord's absence in success. Tart, tart, tart as a grapefruit rind. I could not find where he lived. Then I picked up a pen, found him hiding on the page, calling, calling, calling out my name from between the lines." and then the line from which the psalm is, or the poem is crafted. God girds me with strength and makes my way straight, Psalm 18:33. I love that poem. So from cross to nature when you were a girl, from a sense of vocation at age 19 to a deeper awareness of others in your 20s, and ultimately to the writing of poetry in your 30s. Are all these forms of inspiration similar to you because they come from God, or are they fundamentally different because they inspire you in different ways or to different things? If all these instances of inspiration are divine in their origin, are they all transient and dependent on your circumstances, right? Do you anticipate that, for example, the poetic inspiration you receive today represents only a small or short season of your life, or is there something about this particular form of inspiration, this poetry, that you expect to endure into later phases of your life?
Well, it's interesting because each of these are such unique experiences, and yet at the same time, there's this continuity. And it's essentially the experience of God showing up in moments in ways that sometimes could be named at the time as God and sometimes could not, and only in retrospect, right? And so it's interesting that you use the word inspiration, which is a word that I think of with relationship with creativity, sort of inspiration as is that being in the throes of holy creativity. These to me aren't necessarily moments of creativity, though creativity comes from them, but they're just sort of thin spaces, right? And they're often odd or surprising or unexpected. And I think that that's where we see God, is when we're not expecting him, is in the unexpected places. And so I wanted in that poem to capture something of the surreal nature of where God chooses to show up and what it's like to experience him. And it's not all mountaintop, or it's not all, you know, pastel colors, or it can be sharp, it can be gentle, it can be poetic, it can be a little bit violent, it can be all kinds of things. As for inspiration itself, there was a very distinct experience of inspiration that I had when I was 7 years old. I was in my grandparents' backyard in a hammock under some pine trees, probably a summer day. The birds were singing and their song became very loud to me, and they were very close because these were like dwarf pine trees or short pine trees with low branches. And I just remember the light and the birds, and I just had this very inspiring experience that I just don't even have words to capture, because it was so holy and magical. And I wouldn't have named it as I wouldn't have necessarily named God as a central ingredient of that at the time, but when I look back, he very much was. But that was when I wrote my first poem. I ran inside and grabbed a pen and paper, or pencil and paper. I knew I had to write a poem. And I feel like all of the poetry that I write or have written since, in some ways, is trying to go back there, or reconnect with that experience that I had, which I think speaks to a continuity, despite the changing sensibility that I have as a poet, or changing subject matter, changing interests. But yeah, there is a continuity there for sure. Does that make sense?
It does. I love the nuance in that answer. In that experience of yours, it's so good, right? That these experiences need not all be mountaintop. They can be, as you said, they can be sharp, they can be violent, they can be totally mundane. Right. But there is something about them, though, that does have this kind of continuity, this through line between them, right? That connects them, and that connects you to something really important and primordial, you know, in your own experience. You know, the 7-year-old girl having this experience of bird song and saying, I must write about that. In fact, there's a poem I wonder if you could read. It's a gorgeous poem, again, like so many in this collection. It's called Appointment with Stillness. It's on page 18. It's a beautiful poem about learning how to be quiet and learning how to let the revelatory qualities of God's creation distill themselves upon us. Would you read this one for us?
I would be happy to. Appointment with Stillness. Stand in the company of a tree. You will want to run fast and far. Stay. Remain in the arbor's undergaze as under the eye watch of love. Don't be surprised if you are unable to move. Stunned by a vast silence, redolent of apples and rain, and the precise scent of air on the day you were born. Learn to concede to the slanted light. In time, you will sink to the ground. Let bark imprint its long hand on your back. In time, leaves and winged insects will cantillate their shimmering truths. In time, you will know yourself to be held by what cannot be seen, the white pappus of a dandelion lifted on a playful breeze. And that is inspired by Psalm 16, verse 11, in your presence is fullness of joy.
Okay, you were reading, and I looked over at Sophie and Starling, kind of mouthed, wow, this is a beautiful poem. And when I talk about kind of the poem's synesthetic quality, this sensuous richness, it's lines like this, right? Don't be surprised if you are unable to move, stunned by a vast silence, redolent of apples and rain, and the precise scent of air on the day you were born. That's so great. That's so great. I love that poem.
Thank you.
Do you see poetry as an art that can help us cultivate this capacity for stillness, right? Can poetry actually generate this capacity in readers or in the writers of poetry? Or is it truer to say that poetry just helps us capture feelings of stillness that we have to learn to cultivate through other practices of mind and perhaps worship? In other words, in your sense, does poetry help generate new sensibilities in us, or is it truer to say that poetry merely comments on those that we've already cultivated?
That's a wonderful and important question, and I think that just connecting stillness and poetry is the first thing that you're doing here by asking that question, and that those two things do go together. They resonate, and so they are vehicles of each other, shall we say. But when it comes to reading poetry, I think that poetry's main function is actually to evoke. And if you don't mind, I have a story that I'd like to share that will help explain that. And this took place when I was in third grade, and there's a poem in the book that tells this story, which is, the poem is titled, I Wanted the Woods Like I Wanted Something Lost. So in third grade, I stumbled on a collection of Edna St. Vincent Millay poems in the elementary school library and read them and became fascinated by them and did not understand many of them.
I'm surprised. Yeah.
Okay. Right. That's why I definitely did not understand many of them. But there were a few that really stood out. And the one that sort of stole my heart the most was Afternoon on a Hill. It's a quite beautiful, simple poem. Which I memorized, and it goes like this. I will be the gladdest thing under the sun. I will touch 100 flowers and not pick one. I will look at cliffs and clouds with quiet eyes, watch the wind bow down the grass and the grass rise. And when lights begin to show up from the town, I will mark which one must be mine and then start down. Well, this poem, when I read it and reread it and reread it, it woke something in me. And it was waking something in me that was actually already there, but it was deep, it was hidden, it was unarticulated. And I've come now, looking back, to name that thing that it woke in me as longing. Mm-hmm. It was a longing that had to do with beauty, it had to do with nature, it had to do with contemplation and wanting to be that contemplative and poet who kind of was able to sort of waste time with beauty or waste time with God. I was feeling that longing in the context of being constrained in an institutional setting, right? This is the public, school classroom. And I think I was just very sensitive as a kid. And so I was very sensitive to my surroundings. And so when I read Afternoon on a Hill, I was the poet in the poem, who of course doesn't actually go and spend the afternoon on a hill. She's just dreaming about it. But it gave me permission to do that too. I wanted to be, you know, close to the sky and watching the clouds and touching the petals and counting the lights and letting dusk nudge me when it was time to go home. And so that poem didn't plant something new in me. It didn't plant the longing in me, but it drew it out. It named it, it validated it, and it gave me a way to actually inhabit it. So I think poems give us a way to inhabit our longings. They do the work of naming and so forth, and then they also do the work of giving us a space, a container, for inhabiting our longings. So no, I don't think that poetry necessarily generates something in us that is new so much as it wakens something that is already asleep in us or names something that is unspoken in us.
Okay, that's a great rich response to that. That rings true to me. On that basis, I wonder if I could read another very short poem in here that goes to a kind of an awakening that I find really moving. This is the poem "Lord, I Remember." It's on page 49, and this is a poem that accentuates for me the relationship between poetry and our experience of God, right? And what that evokes. Here it is. "Lord, I remember when the priest kneeled on green carpet, dipped 12 men and women's feet in a white water-filled bowl, toweled their exposed heels and toes. Incense rose. We sang. You came near, whispered in my ear, friend." And this is based on Psalm 42:6. "I rehearse everything I know of you." Okay. That poem I find really incredibly striking. That the way it concludes that sense of a you, capital Y, that implicitly God drawing near and speaking intimately and simply, friend. It's a lovely way to capture this gently electrifying quality of a spiritual experience, right? An experience of God. And I'd love to know if there are things you want to say in addition, right, about this, why this poem kind of came to you the way that it did, if there's a special relationship between poetry and prayer, or if there is an appreciable difference, it seems important to you, between poetry and prayer, right? Because this kind of experience one might have in a prayerful setting, here it's a poetic one. So there's a connection, but they aren't the same. I'm wondering if you could comment on a little bit for me.
I think you're touching on a very, very deep mystery here, Matthew. The relationship between poetry and prayer, it's a deep mystery. I don't think that that can be teased out fully. But it's worth exploring. And I guess I would start off with a short answer and say, like, poetry, and I think I've already alluded to this, is and can be a form of prayer. It isn't by definition prayer, I don't think, but it very well can be prayer. And when I write poetry, I feel like I get to be Adam in the garden who's naming, the plants and the animals, and like I get to do this creative, holy naming, which is in and of itself a kind of prayer. Just naming that experience, like naming the experience that I had, and that also was as a young child, on Holy Thursday, growing up in the Catholic Church, and having a sense of something very holy and special happening, but in a casual way, as if God was with me as a friend, and like naming that, like I felt that, but I didn't. The word friend is not actually a word that I would have used then, but it's exactly what I felt. And so I named it looking back on it. So I guess I would add that attentiveness before God is its own kind of prayer. Attentiveness before God to God's world, right? As Adam is attentive to God's world and naming the animals. I can be attentive to God's world and naming experience, naming what I see in God's world, naming where I see him at work in the landscape of my life, both internally and externally. So writing a form, writing poetry can actually, I think, be a very healing form of prayer because it can take us a little bit deeper sometimes than we would go without a pen in hand or without engaging our creativity or our imagination. We don't often draw on our imagination in prayer, just sort of maybe in our own sort of devotional time, unless we've intentionally worked that in. But like metaphor can be very powerful as a tool for imagination, and Jesus uses it all the time when he's teaching and teaching in parables and teaching in images. I actually wrote an essay about the relationship between poetry and prayer that if your listeners want to read a little bit more about my thoughts on it, it's available online. It was first published in Ruminate magazine, but it's on, I think it's been republished on a website called Chronic Joy. And it's the article is called Finding a Vocabulary of the Heart, What Poetry Has Taught Me About Prayer. And so I'll just point folks to that if they want a little bit more there, because there's so much to unpack.
Oh, that's great. Folks might mean my students and me, right? Because,
okay.
Yeah, I teach a class on literature and spiritual experience, and we read a lot of poetry, and that sounds just perfect for what we talk about a lot in that class. Ways that poems can name experiences, but also ways that poems help focus attention on when these moments of intensification of our experience that we associate with an experience of the sacred, when these things happen, how they happen, how to become more aware of them. And this is great. You know, I've been directing us to poems in the collection, but let me ask you now, is there a poem in the collection that's your favorite? You know, if so, which one could you read it to us and explain what for you is so powerful about it?
I have a hard time naming one or even a few as favorites, but I would be happy to read. Actually, I have two poems that sort of function as a suite. As I've been giving readings, a lot of these poems are very short in here, and I've been realizing actually when you string them, they seem to talk to each other and create almost a greater effect than any one poem can. So I will read a poem called Confession in the Age of Scarcity Culture. And in our culture, I think, and in our sin, we're very good at hiding from others and hiding from God and hiding from ourselves. And we become strangers very quickly to God, to others, even to ourselves. And W. David O. Taylor says in his book about the Psalms that they help us to unhide. And I love that. And so one of the ways that the Psalms can help us to unhide is through confession. I think of certain Psalms as being Psalms of confession. And so this is a confession. And I'll define scarcity culture here as a hyper focus on lack, right? So the mantra of scarcity culture, it could be not successful enough, not beautiful enough, not smart enough, not good enough. The biblical worldview is the opposite. It says, the Lord is my shepherd. I have all that I need. The biblical worldview invites us to live by gratitude and embrace simplicity and operate out of a sense of security rooted in the abundant love and grace of God. But as we read in Psalm 64, the heart and the mind are cunning. And so even when we embrace a biblical worldview, we're still apt to fall back into the world's ways of thinking, aren't we? So I'll read Confession in the Age of Scarcity Culture, followed by the second poem in the compilation, which is called Only Ask. And it's actually written through the voice of God, as the psalmist writes in the voice of God, only ask, and I will give you the nations as your inheritance, the whole earth as your possession. So, Confession in the Age of Scarcity Culture. Psalm 64, 5. Surely the human heart and mind are cunning. I have believed the glaring industrial lie of too little time. It has wound me up to spin and spin. I have glittered myself with facts designed to impress. I have inhabited the creed. I am only what I plot, plan, piece together from mantras, dream scraps, free advice. Oh, save me from the lovelessness of fear. Forgive my adultery with the gospel of more, my fierce love affair with getting things done, my stout allegiance to independence, the other term for loneliness. Forgive me for scorning silence, ignoring whisper in favor of shout. I confess, cold shouldering rest, going AWOL from love, high pedestaling the antithesis of enough. Only ask. Psalm 2, verse 8. Only ask, and I will give you the nations as your inheritance, the whole earth as your possession. Only ask, and I will cool your tongue with water from clean depths of the lake that is forever. Only ask, and I will set a table of peace between you and fear, and the candle of my presence will burn through the night veil of your dimmest hour. Only ask, and my hushed gaze will become a shelter more vast than the watch of winter stars, stronger than sun's tomorrow. Yours is forest and sea, yours a gratuity of days, each one jeweled, wine red, glittering, rare. Yours the compass rose of my voice, pointing north, pointing due rest, due light, due song. Yes, only ask, and I will breathe your new name across the flush tabula of dawn, bear you across the wide threshold of time, let you in on the laughter by which nebulae are formed.
Lovely. Those are great. You know, and I love that you read them together. Because it was interesting. You read the first one, Confession in the Age of Scarcity Culture. And I found myself, it was an interesting experience. I mean, to go back to some of those poems, right? I have glittered myself with facts designed to impress. I've inhabited the creed. I am only what I plot, plan, piece together from mantras, dreams, scraps, free advice. Forgive my adultery with a gospel of more, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I found myself implicated in some ways in that poem. And yet the second poem, Only Ask, suggests, you know, the wonderful presence of God all around us if we are only attentive and willing to actually open ourselves to it. What's interesting about that then is that first poem, I found myself thinking, you know, I try not to fall into those habits, and yet, of course, I do, right? And yet, around the fact that you articulate those thoughts, which are, for me, anxiety-inducing thoughts of implication, in the form of a lovely poem is a version of the answer you provide, or that God provides in the poem, Only Ask, right? Only be attentive, in this case here, to the rhythms, to the line, to the language, to the breath, to the meter. It's a way of saying, even in the things that cause us grief, there's still a hand extended, right, from God, if we are willing to be a little more still, a little more aware, and try to creep outside of these habits of what you call loveless fear. So I when you read those two together, I found the experience of feeling myself implicated inside lovely poetry to be really resonant with what you're articulating.
Well, it was instructive to me to read these aloud because I found myself reading the first one, I think, faster and the second one slower. And I was thinking about the sort of pace of humans versus the pace of God and the way we, in our grabbing, in our acquiring, in our producing, we're trying to get ahead, and but we're not actually satisfied, and so there's this further, deeper, sort of higher grabbing, and you know, and so forth, and then there's just this sort of calm in the second poem that, I wasn't expecting to read them so differently, and I don't know if they were heard as differently as they felt read differently to me, but I thought that was instructive.
So I became acquainted with your work through the 2018 collection of poems you published, Habitation of Wonder, and there are several poems in that collection that I love. And in fact, I initially asked you to be on this podcast to talk about this collection. You said, "Well, I've got another collection coming out," you know, which was yet nicer still to sort of we went in, and then on two collections that I knew and loved. I wonder though if I could raise read part of one poem in here that I find especially moving. I'll read up kind of about half of it, and then I'm going to ask you about it. It's the poem "Learning to Pray" on page 12. Here it is: "Learning to Pray. When I say I have passed the afternoon watching loose strife lean against the wind at the edge of the lake. What I mean is, I have stepped into prayer, not unlike Peter stepping out of the boat, and it has held me, as prayer does, like a child holds a penny, or ferns hold beads of dew. When slippage occurs, as it is wont to do, and I begin to sink through unraveling molecules of faith, like a dream sinks back into the dark when dawn dissolves the net of sleep, I am caught by a quiet grip, an open palm, the way air catches a parachute or a June buttercup catches light. And there is in that catching a new kind of drowning, not unpleasant, though it surprises at first. And this is just, it's so great. Such a beautiful poem. I love the intimacy of your insights into prayer. I love it. And I want to ask you about that, because there are three kind of distinct kind of mediating elements at work here that make these kinds of insights in the poem possible. I'm wondering how you understand the relationship between them. The first is your experience of prayer, just you as a person who prays, who has an experience then of God's responsiveness to your prayers. The second is poetry itself, right? The ways that its images and language and structuring devices actually can also help to, as you say, call out or evoke feelings that we have, but they also give them new shape, kind of a new life to them. They structure and order and make more present or more apparent to us things that we may have namelessly or wordlessly felt. And the third element here is biblical allusion. Here of Peter's experience of walking on water, right? I recount in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 14. Is there one of these insights that takes primacy for you in your poetry on prayer, your own experience, the structuring of the poem, or the biblical allusion?
Yeah, I think any insight into prayer, first of all, I just want to give a nod to Scott Cairns, the poet Scott Cairns, whose work very much inspired this particular poem. Scott Cairns writes poems that very deftly explore and capture some of the inner architecture or choreography, maybe is a better word, of spiritual experience.
I love Scott Cairns.
And
yeah.
Prayer. Yeah. But I would say in terms of insights into prayer that have come in writing poetry, I think, and this is for sure true for this poem, image would be that primary insight, in this case, the image of the lake, and then the metaphorical layers that any image can offer, and in this case, the image of the lake. I live quite near Lake Champlain here in Vermont, and I go to the lake often, and when I do, I find it always opens me up to prayer, and that it has a calming effect on me, and that I find that I'm quite content to be quiet when I'm at the lake, to be still, to soak in the beauty, and to pay attention actually to how God wants to meet me there. Like, what does he want to speak to me about himself or about myself or what he's doing in my life, like through the lake, through the mountains on the other side of Lake Champlain, which is about 11 miles across where I live, are the Adirondacks. And so through the mountains or through the white sailboat just against the vast blue in the distance, or the swallows that are darting for insects above the water, or the wind, or the far clouds letting down rain miles away. Like, what is it how is it that God wants to meet me in those things, or what is he whispering through those things? Dag Hammarskjöld, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, has this lovely little quote, which is in and of itself a poem. He says, "A landscape can sing about God." I love that. And I wonder, can God sing to us through landscape? And so this is a poem that comes from listening to God at the lake and really paying attention to the canvas of the landscape as a canvas through which God is very possibly speaking.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I have loved this conversation. I got time for one more question to ask you. This is so great. Thank you for your time and your beautiful, beautiful poetry. Here's the question. So if you could orchestrate the kind of poetic inspiration you hope to receive, and orchestration of it is not in the nature of these things, I understand it. So this is a total artifice. But if you could orchestrate the kind of inspiration that you wanted to receive as a poet, if you could coax the muses, right, or perhaps receive from God inspiration to write something particular, my question is, what kind of collection of poems, you know, you still hope to produce? That is, what might you create? It still seems perhaps a little beyond your experience or capacity.
That is such a great question. And I'm going to disappoint you on it. This is kind of a hard question for me right now, because I just don't feel as though I have the imagination for writing something vastly different than what I've currently been doing. So I spent like a couple years on those Psalms. And then I stepped back from them, and I had missed writing more from personal experience, or more from, just images from my life, more nature and so forth. And so I've been doing a lot of memory work, looking back and trying to write poems about things in my childhood that I've never sort of given myself the freedom to write poems about, or maybe thought I never could write about them. And that's been a really good palate cleanser. So I feel like I'm right now on the threshold of stepping back into the Psalms, because the Psalms, as you may have mentioned, that I drew on for this book are the first 75 Psalms. And so what about the next 75 Psalms? I never sort of made a commitment, but they do feel like they're calling my name a little bit. So I'm wondering what it will be like on the other side of Cut My Days Like Water a few years later, a little bit of a different person, as we all are, you know, as we travel through time. Can I find new prayers? I think I can. And I'm excited about the possibility, and I'm excited for where God might want to meet me in that, where he will surprise me in that, and what prayers the Psalms will draw out of me that I didn't know were there in me. So that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
Well, I am not disappointed by that at all. I would love to read more poems in this vein. So thank you so much for your beautiful and truly inspired work, Abby. It's been a delight talking with you.
Thanks so much for having me. I've enjoyed our conversation very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Sophia Snyder and Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.